Well, thank you very much, Wyman. I appreciate that. I appreciate everyone showing up this afternoon. I didn't know that something 3,000 years old could bring so much interest. I am teased by my students at Rochester College that once you get past 1000 BC, I become bored. I am way, way back there in the past. One time at the dinner table, we were having this discussion, and one of my sons, I have three boys, and one of my sons, my youngest one, is going to turn 22, so I realize I don't look old enough to have sons of that age. I have two daughters-in-laws, and they are so wonderful. I wished I had not had the sons and just started with the daughter-in-laws. But anyway, we were having this discussion at the table, and one of my sons was wanting to engage in an activity that I didn't want him to engage in, but I wasn't going to tell him, no, have you been there? Because of his age. I wanted him to decide for himself, and obviously I wanted him to decide for himself what I wanted him to decide, but still, I wanted him to decide for himself. So finally he kept pressing, and he kept pressing, and he kept pressing, and he kept pressing, and I finally just said, no. And he said, Dad, you're just pre-Jurassic. And I said, 1 point for learning how to insult me creatively. Another point for a science fiction reference that I really do enjoy. No. So, in some ways, I am pre-Jurassic. It's a real joy to be here at the Abilene Lectureship. It's been an incredibly full several days. I've tried to pace myself so that I would stay awake during this session. I did, however, go to the hotel and put a nice fresh shirt on, and then there was no van service, so I walked back and got these nice big sweat rings. And people have told me I look very Texan. I'm kind of hoping, you know, to get back to the north so I won't be so cold. I've been teasing folks, your air conditioning kicks on down here when it hits 70, I guess. Air conditioning is... I lived in Minnesota for 15 and a half years. We had air conditioning. We use it all summer long, both days. So, at any rate, I used to kid people when they would come to Minnesota and ask them, do you like winter sports? They usually would say yes, or they just look at you. I'd say, well, that's really good because we have 10 months of them here. The other 2 months is just too cold. But we... At any rate, it is a joy to be with you. I want to say a few things about the book of Genesis. In the other room, I'd written a bunch of stuff on the board, which you really don't need. They're just a big bunch of big words that I'll be referring to, and it would have been easier, I guess, for you to see them. Or maybe I thought if I put them on the board, you would know that I hadn't made them up. I could have, but they look like, wow, these look really like officially cool words. For many people today, the stories of Genesis are a little more than just a part of their childhood heritage. They're lumped along with stories like Cinderella, Jack and the Beanstalk, Winnie the Pooh. Some even think of Genesis much like the writings of Dr. Seuss. Fanciful tales that point to the truth, but cannot be taken as the truth themselves. What are we to make of the creation of the world in 6 days, or Eve being made from Adam's rib, or Methuselah living to the age of 969 years? It's stories like these that hardly suggest to the modern reader that Genesis makes a serious claim to truth. And so skeptics tend to treat Genesis with disbelief and disdain. Christians are often embarrassed by Genesis and feel like they must come to its rescue and defend it. I believe that both reactions are unjustified. When Genesis was written, it was a revolutionary book that challenged the beliefs of its age. And it is this unique and revolutionary character of Genesis that I want to talk about in our time together today. There are a lot of ways that we could talk about the book of Genesis. There's a Hebrew term called toledoth, which is often translated either generations or descendants, or it can mean account, story, or history. It can go either way. And the book of Genesis has nice 10 sections broken off. Next time you read through it, notice, and this is the account of the heavens and the earth, or these are the generations or descendants of so-and-so and so-and-so, and breaks the book up into 10 nice panels. And that's one way you can structure the book of Genesis. A very simple way to do it is the first 11 chapters, roughly. I mean, it's like 1 chapter 1 to 11, verse 26. The first 11 chapters are primeval history. Chapters 12 through 50 are patriarchal history. Chapters 1 through 11 cover about 2,000 years. Now that's when the clock starts running, because I don't know when to start the clock, to be honest. I don't know how long creation took. I certainly don't know how long Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden before they sinned. However, I know that if I had been there 5, 10 minutes, however long it would have taken to get to the tree. I just, my parents have assured me of that. Don't eat from that tree. Which one? That one. Okay. So the first 11 chapters cover about 2,000 years. The last part, chapters 12 through 50, cover about 400, it's 360-something, but about 400 years, which makes a very disproportionate arrangement for this book. You have this big chunk of time, 2,000 years, that's only 20% of the book. And then you have 400 years, it's roughly 80% of the book. And so it goes at warp speed, going through all these things that are tantalizing to me, because I'm like, whoa, I got a lot more questions here. Whoa, boom, gets to Abraham and it slows down, which I think should tip you off that our narrator, and I just refer to the author as the narrator, our narrator cannot wait to get to the story of Abraham. Just cannot wait to get there. And then things really began to slow down. One of the ways I like to study the way of Genesis is to go through and study the theme of deception. There are so many schemes in the book of Genesis. I mean, we start off, we humans, by being duped by the serpent. Abraham's pawning his wife off all the time. You know that one. As Sarah, it's believed every time. Notice that. Jacob literally pulls the wool over his father's eyes. He dupes Esau, but that wasn't too hard. I mean, Esau was a dimwit at best. Then Jacob runs into Laban. I call that the Laban principle. Whatever bad habit you have, God will see to it that you run into someone in your life that's badder at it than you are, and you're going to pay. And so the man that masqueraded as his brother winds up getting the woman who's masquerading as her sister. Jacob is fooled. Jacob's sons. There's all kinds of irony in the book of Genesis. Jacob's sons grow up to be about as good and cunning as their father. The Shechemite story is a horrible story of lying and deception. Of course, then what they do with Joseph, lie to their dad about that. Then Joseph in the end can pull a few pranks of his own. So you can go through Genesis and you can look at all of these human schemes and they all work, which is the problem. When you get done reading Genesis, it should be crystal clear that if there is any hope for humanity whatsoever, it will not be based on the humans. There is no way that the humans, with their brilliance and intellect and cleverness, all they do is just mess everything up. And so you can look at the book that way. I like, one of my favorite stories is the Joseph story, because it gives such a happy ending to the book. We begin by being created in the image of God, which in short, and there's a lot of discussion about that, in short, being created in the image of God is we are deputized by God to be His representatives. We are called upon to have mastery and exercise dominion over the created order and to do so as God's representative. We do not do a very good job of it. But you come to Joseph. And Joseph is the image of God to the world. He does actually, literally, exercise mastery over the physical resources of the earth to the welfare of everyone. And so the book ends by saying it is possible. It is possible we can be what we were created to be. However, you will notice in the Joseph story, there is a refrain just repeated bukus of times, and the Lord was with Joseph, and the Lord was with Joseph, and the Lord was with Joseph. When we are in partnership with God, we can be what we were created to be. Well, those are all kinds of things that we're not going to pursue today. What I want to do is something a little different. I'm not a very good actor, and I'm not good in drama or that sort of thing. But I want to try to pretend that I am a nearly 3,000-year-old Babylonian. My son, who called me pre-Jurassic, would agree with that in many ways, that I'm about that old. And I want to try as best I can just to kind of forget about the separation of space and time. And I want to imagine being with you today as someone who read the book of Genesis in 900 B.C. And so I begin by saying, good afternoon, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Enkidu. Randy Harris likes to call me Enkidu, but anyway, my name is Enkidu. My parents named me after the companion that was created for Gilgamesh by the divine assembly. I am a Babylonian merchant. I make my living in the international trade of spices, which means I am able to travel a lot, experience other cultures. I moved to Jerusalem in 900 BC. On the second day in my new residence, I met my Hebrew neighbor by the name of Joshua. He was very friendly. He was very helpful. And, oh, I guess it was about a month after my arrival in Jerusalem in 900 BC that he gave me this propaganda pamphlet. Gave me this evangelistic tract. It's called Bereshit, what you nowadays call the book of Genesis. And I'm here today to share with you my impressions of this book. I have four main points, but before I begin with those points, I must say that the beginning of this book is extremely odd. I make no claim to be an expert in Mesopotamian or Canaanite or Egyptian religion, but I do believe, because of my education and my travels, and I'm fairly knowledgeable about these religious views in these cultures, the book of Genesis simply begins with, "In the beginning, God." And then it continues without offering any explanation as to the origin of this God. This is extremely odd. Now, the so-called pagan cosmologies give you all kinds of background of the God. But not only does Genesis not give it at the start, Genesis exhibits no interest whatsoever in the question of God's origins. There is no ancestry. There is no genealogy. There are no divine births. There are no divine deaths. There is no definition of this God. There is no description of this God's nature. I have been told that for the first time in the history of the Near East, God was thought of as being entirely free from temporal and spatial dimensions. This is really odd. It is remarkably unique. And so from the very beginning, I was bewildered. And then to add to my confusion, I couldn't figure out whether or not this God was a he or a she. Even after I'd read the whole book, I still don't know. Since this God, I couldn't find anywhere in there that this God had any sexual consort or companion, I was in the dark as to the gender of this God. Then my Hebrew neighbor told me that this God was non-sexual, and I had never, ever heard of such a thing. And so what is missing from the beginning of the book is obvious to someone like myself. These omissions are obvious. Genesis claims to begin at the beginning, and yet it has nothing at all to say about the beginning of God. This is extremely odd. If you will pardon my wordplay, this God is odd. And it is the oddness of this God that I want to talk about today. First, according to the book of Genesis, there is only one God. Now, this was new to me. You ought to realize that by the standards of the ancient Near East, that Genesis is quite a young document. I am vaguely familiar with some Egyptian materials that date back to around the mid-third millennium BC. I want to define two words that I had up on the board in the other room, so if you want to go over there real quick and look at... No, we won't do that. Define a couple of words, cosmogony and cosmology. A cosmogony is an account or a theory concerning the origin of the universe. A cosmology is a philosophy or a theory concerning the nature and the principles of the universe, either as a whole or its various parts. In other words, cosmogony deals with the origin. The origin. Cosmology is more about the nature. How does it work? Whether all of its totality or its various parts. Okay, cosmogony, cosmology, cosmogony, origin, cosmology, the nature of the beast, so to speak. The Egyptian cosmogonies are connected with local deities. We have Ra, R-E, Atum, A-T-U-M, and Ptah, P P-T-A-H, so if you want to know how to spell it right, you always go Ptah. You can get it like that. And although different gods play the role of creator in the various cosmogonies, each cosmogony has only one creator god. And this one creator god is the primeval god who is self-generated. Now let me tell you some of these stories, the ones that I'm very familiar with. There is the cosmogony from the city of Heliopolis. There the god Atum generates the divine couple. The divine couple is Shu. Shu is the air god. Tefnut is the goddess of moisture. Atum generates Shu and Tefnut either by a sexual activity that if I described it you would be disgusted, or he does so by spitting. Shu and Tefnut then give birth to Geb. Geb is the earth god. And to birth to Nut, who is the sky goddess. And these two, I'm sure you're keeping up with all these, right? I mean, it's how the world got here. And these two, Geb and Nut, remember Geb, the earth god, Nut, the sky goddess, are separated by Shu, who is the air god. The earth and the sky are separated by air. That's the Heliopolis cosmogony. In Memphite, from the city of Memphis theology, the creator god is Ta. He creates nine gods called the Aeneid, E-N-N-E-A-D. And he begins with Shu and Tefnut. The truth is that most Egyptian cosmogonies are really theogonies. They are far more interested and concerned about the origin of the gods than they are the origin of the universe. The Canaanite beliefs. The main source of Canaanite beliefs comes from Ugarit, going back to about the 14th century B.C. There is a Baal, B-A-A-L, Baal cycle of texts, but we don't really have any for certain Canaanite cosmogony. The chief of the pantheon is El, E-L. He is called the creator of creatures, the creator of creation, the father of humanity. El's wife's name is Asherah, A-S-H-E-R-A-H. She is given the title creator or begetter of the gods. These descriptive designations suggest that the Canaanites thought of creation in terms of procreation. There is one ritual text that tells of the birth of the gods Shahar and Shalim, and they come about as the result of El's sexual exploits. Mesopotamia, my homeland, of course. Now, whenever we talk about Mesopotamia, we'll make a rough distinction between Sumerian and Akkadian. Sumerian is the bit older. We have Sumerian materials that are roughly 3rd to early 2nd millennium BC. 3rd, this is getting really old. 3rd to early 2nd millennium BC. Then we have the Akkadian materials that are roughly the middle of the 2nd millennium coming up to the 1st millennium BC. You will notice, of course, when I give these dates, how old these stories are in comparison to Genesis. I must confess that when I read Genesis for the first time, I was very skeptical because it was so modern. There are at least two Sumerian traditions. One comes from the city of Nippur. In it, creation takes place through the union of heaven, who is the god An, A-N, and earth, who is the goddess Antum, A-N-T-U-M, or she's also called Ki. So from Nippur comes the tradition of creation through the union of heaven, An, and earth, Antum or Ki. This union fertilizes the earth to produce vegetable, animal, and human life, and all this just sprouts from the ground like plants. The other tradition comes from Eridu, E-R-I-D-U, and in this Enki, E-N-K-I, the god of fertility and wisdom, produces the spring water that fertilizes the earth, and there's all these rivers and canals and life, including human life, and cities all spring up along the banks of the rivers and the canals. But I've saved the best for last. From the perspective of the 21st century AD, the best known Akkadian cosmogonies are contained within two lengthy narratives, the Atrahasis, A-T-R-A-H-A-S-I-S, the Atrahasis epic, and Enuma Elish, E-N-U-M-A and E-L-I-S-H. The most complete copy of Atrahasis comes from the early 17th century B.C. The story begins at a time when only the gods exist. Now we have the lesser gods. The lesser gods are the Igg, I-G, I-G, I. I think I got that right. I-G, I, G, I. Right. Kind of like you folks trying to spell Mississippi. Anyway, we have the lesser gods, the Igg. We have the senior gods, the Anunnaki, A-N-U-N-N-A-K-I. Okay? Now, the Igg, being the lesser gods, they're the peons of the gods. That's all there is to it. They do all the menial labor, all the chores, all that sort of thing. And after many years, they get tired of doing all that, and they go on strike, and this creates quite a problem. So Enki, along with the mother goddess, they create humans so that we can do this work for the gods, and the humans are created from clay and blood and the spirit of an Igg god, and this takes care of the laborers. That's Atrahasis. The Enuma Elish is usually dated back to between the 14th and 11th centuries B.C. As a Babylonian, or what you folks would call an ancient Iraqi, this would be a story that I am the most familiar with. After all, it tells about Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K. I know about Marduk because he is the supreme god. That's all there is to it. He's the Babylonian god of cosmic order. And this story, the Enuma Elish, which is literally the opening words, which means went on high, tells the story of how Marduk is elevated to the supreme possession in the Babylonian pantheon. It doesn't surprise me, obviously, that this is one of the most copied stories in ancient history. Furthermore, it was recited on the fourth day of the New Year festival in Babylon. And so it's a story I've heard many times. At the beginning of this story, the Elish, nothing exists but the primeval waters. Apsu, A-P-S-U. Apsu is the divine water. Tiamat, T-I-A-M-A-T. Tiamat is the divine patron of salt water. And so they get together. The older gods. But Apsu doesn't like these gods. Their activity disturbs him, and so he just plans he's going to just kill them all, eradicate them. Ea, E-A, puts Apsu to sleep with a spell and kills him. Then Ea builds a palace on Apsu's corpse, in which he and Damkina give birth to Marduk. Marduk turns out to be greater than any of his predecessors, but Tiamat doesn't like the way he plays, and so she rounds up some gods who are seemingly provoked by jealousy of Marduk. And so we've got Tiamat, this bunch of dissident gods, and a horde of chaos monsters that Tiamat makes. And they're going to destroy all the other gods. Well, when they hear about this, and I'm sure you're keeping up with all the other gods that the other gods are going to kill, right? You got all that. Good, good. When they hear of this, the other gods are filled with fear. And they don't know what to do. Marduk comes along, great Marduk comes along and says, I will do battle on your behalf. There is a condition, of course. If I win, I want to be boss. If I win, I want to have the power of determining destinies. I want to be made king. Well, given he's the only really choice on the horizon and a pretty good one at that, they say, have at it. So Marduk goes out to do battle with Tiamat, the dissident gods, and the horde of chaos monsters created by Tiamat. Marduk is smart enough to anger Tiamat enough to get her into a single one-on-one combat, and he kills her. He splits her body in two. With one half he makes the sky, with the other half he makes the earth. He puts the stars in their places. He establishes the movement of the sun and the moon. Seeing all this, all the other gods say, you're great, you're wonderful, they acclaim him, they make him king. Marduk then orders Ea to make humans. And the humans are made out of the blood of Kingu. Kingu was the leader of the dissident gods. And he is slain. And the humans are made from his blood so that the humans can now do all the chores for the gods. The gods themselves, however, build Babylon. And its temple is Marduk's dwelling place. And they glorify Marduk with 50 names. So, how are you doing with keeping up with all these names? You got all this straight? Take out a piece of paper, I'm going to give you a test. No. OK. Can you imagine then how stunned I was when I read just the opening lines of the book of Genesis? Can you imagine how stunning that was? There is only one God. There is no multitude of deities. There is no big group of deities who are vying for supremacy and struggling within themselves as to who will emerge as supreme and sovereign. Now, personally, I think that many Americans would like the Mesopotamian stories because there's lots of sex and violence. And I think they would like that. But you read the creation story in Genesis 1. There's no sex, not amongst gods. There's no violence. There's no multitude of gods. There's only one God. And that is stunning. That is incredible. And to be honest, I found it very appealing. My second observation. I was struck by the power of this one creator God. No, I wasn't literally struck. But I was struck by the power of the Genesis God. This God seems to know everything and to be able to do anything. He, and I guess I'll just give up and start calling him a he, because I'm still trying to figure out this thing about God's non-sexual distinction. But he is portrayed in almost exclusively masculine imagery, and I suppose that that is fitting for someone who has more power than any male in a patriarchal society. So we'll just call him he. He is both omniscient and omnipotent. He knows all and apparently can do all. He speaks, and the world appears perfectly ordered, so that after 6 days of divine activity, the whole universe is done and declared to be very good. As we have seen in these other creation stories from the ancient world, creation was often a long, drawn-out process that involved battles and conflict and strife with both a number of deities and monsters. But in Genesis, creation by this God is depicted orderly and good. Effortless, orderly, and good. Unlike anything I had ever heard of or read. But I need to point out that it was not the creation story, but it was the flood story that most impressed me with this God's power. And although it pains me to admit it, the Mesopotamian flood stories do not flatter the gods. In the Atrahasis epic, the humans are growing in number. Kind of like having too many kids in the house. They're making too much noise. They're making too much racket. The gods are not able to get their sleep. Enlil, E-N-L-I-L. Enlil is tired of being kept awake. So getting up on the wrong side of the bed, so to speak, the gods plot to destroy the human race by a series of plagues, and finally by a flood. Only Atrahasis survived the flood, and that's because they got a secret warning from Enki. Enki didn't agree with the decision, and Atrahasis was his devotee, so he said, "Hey, would really be smart if you'd build a boat." So he did. So almost all of the humans are wiped out. Apparently, the gods did not think of this result ahead of time, because now the gods realize how much they relied on the humans. For 7 days and 7 nights, the flood covered the earth. Nintu and the divine assembly wept. Why? Because the temples were dead, the gods were dead, there were no sacrifices for the gods to eat or drink. So after the flood, they allow for put in some safeguards against overpopulation. There's another Akkadian document that I want to bring to your attention called the Gilgamesh epic. And even though this epic as a piece came together probably around the first millennium BC, Some of the Gilgamesh sources that it incorporates date to the second half of the third millennium BC. Now, the flood segment of the Gilgamesh epic is generally considered to have been adapted from Atrahasis, but we've got more stuff here. The Gilgamesh epic describes how the gods collectively decided to destroy the human race with a flood. But we've got a god that doesn't agree with that, Ea, disagreed, Ea, Enki, they're the same people. Ea disagreed with the decision and tipped off his devotee. Now his devotee was Utnapishtim. I just call him Ut. It's a lot easier. All right, Ut, you really need to build a barge. And once the flood came, it was beyond the gods' control. They were so frightened by what they had unleashed that they cowered in the corner like dogs. Furthermore, when the flood was over, one of the top three gods, Enlil, E-N-L-I-L, shows up at the sacrifice of Ut. It's like, what's a human doing? I thought we wiped all these critters out. Surprised, astonished to find a human survivor. To summarize, the Mesopotamian gods are first resolute when the flood decree is made, then terrified when the storm is raging, then bitter and full of regret at the result, and finally indignant at Enlil, who is blamed as the responsible party and made a scapegoat for the whole debacle. Enlil is basically a short-sighted bully who is easily outwitted. You also see how dependent the gods are on the humans. Because when they show up at this sacrifice, and the word it literally says, read the story, they swarmed like flies. And so here is this sacrifice. And they're undernourished, I guess, if a god can be undernourished. And so they swarm like flies, sacrifice, and you see how dependent they are. The gods of Mesopotamia were neither in control of the flood, nor did they know exactly what was happening. They were neither omniscient nor omnipotent. But this Genesis God is remarkably different. The flood begins exactly. He opened the door to the ark. Then when this God remembers Noah, it starts to subside. Finally,